Right, good afternoon. I hope you had a good weekend. There was a request to look at the problem with the two different partitions. And did you want to see both parts or just
the second
one with the cosets? So what we have is we that uses part A. So in part A, okay. So we have, and that was something 46.
42, I guess.
42. The answer to everything. So we have two partitions. And I think we implicitly want that it's in the same. This is two ways how to write the set B1, B2, BL. And we have the condition that if we take K of the B's, any K of the B's include elements from at least K of the A's. Right? Probably formulated slightly different, but that was the condition. And what we can now do is we can take a bipartite graph. On the one side we write the A's. BL. And on the other side we write the B's. B1 up to BL. And now we connect if they contain a shared element. So these connections mean shared element. Okay. So what this condition now says, that any K of the B's have at least K of the A neighbors. So Hall's marriage theorem tells us there is we can find a matching, a perfect matching, right? So Hall's theorem, find the perfect matching. And or if you want Koenig's theorem or so. And now I want to have the common representatives. Basically, I want to pick every edge corresponds to an intersection. So pick from each intersection one element as representative. From the indicated okay, so why does this give me a set of common set of representatives? Well, clearly if there the intersections are non-trivial, otherwise I don't have an edge. So I can pick elements there. And these elements are in both sets. So clearly they would be representatives for both sets. Why are they distinct? Well, if the element I'm choosing here also would be chosen as element somewhere else, well, then let's say it was chosen also for this edge, then that element is not just in the set B1, but also in the set A2, and therefore there will also be an edge here. It's just not an edge which I have chosen. And similarly, there must be then an edge here, because the element is in both of them. And how can I? If I choose these, why can I?
I thought the AIs were a partition.
Oh, right. That's what I need to use somewhere. Thank you. Yes, they are a partition. So, if that element was also So if that point was the point which is in A1 cannot be in any other of the A's, and if it's in B1 it cannot be in any other of the B's. Yes, because they intersect trivially, that situation cannot happen, and therefore they're distinct representatives. Okay, now in the case of cosets, right cosets and left cosets. The sets clearly are supposed to be right cosets and left cosets. So let's say S is a subgroup of G. And we write G is the union over SRI, right cosets, and I write it as left cosets, LJ union over LJS, and AI shall be the coset, the right coset number I, and BI shall be the left coset I. Okay. That's the partition. Now I need to check that condition, that any k of the any k left cosets involve elements from at least k right cosets. So why does that hold? So it holds, okay, if the code. That's just a size argument, right? That's just the size argument. All of these have the same size. And the size of any AI is the size of any BJ, because I have a partition into sets of the same size. So just by getting enough elements, if I have K of the Bs, I have K times the order of S many elements. How many A's do I need to make this up? Well, I can't get every element with less than K A's, because the A's have the same size. So I need the same number. So because of that order argument, I have that condition fulfilled, and then it follows from part A. The common representatives would be, the set of common representatives would be the simultaneous representatives for right cosets and left cosets. This is not saying that the right cosets are equal to the left cosets. They're in general not. This is not saying something with normal subgroup. It's just you can choose the representatives in this weird way that they are simultaneous. Okay. Good. Any other question?
Yeah. Problem 47. Show that in every maximal flow, every minimal cut must be at capacity.
Yes.
I'm not sure how that's different from the max flow min cut theorem. Theorem 4.11.
So the max flow min cut theorem says the minimal capacity of a cut which is possible is the maximal flow possible through the network. Okay. And the way we have gotten to it, or if you look at the algorithm, it is, yes, the algorithm stops once we find where the flow can't be increased, and at the same time we find a cut through which the flow is that flow. That is one cut. You could theoretically have multiple cuts, and they could theoretically somehow overlap on certain edges. Well, I mean, in the end they can't, but if you just look at it abstractly, they could share something or so. Why do all the... That's just what this problem is, and it's not much more than the Max-Flominkat theorem. But you could, for example, you could have a long network and there are multiple bottlenecks, which would be cuts, just one after the other. Well, then that the flow through each of them has to be at the capacity of that cut.
Okay.
Right? We know, because the other thing is a cut, the flow can't be bigger. But would it be possible that somehow at this cut it goes a different route through other pipes which have bigger capacity? Well, it cannot. But I think there is a... It's not a deep statement. It's not much, but I think there is a little bit where the one line argument to show why this holds, which one needs to prove, which actually needs a proof, which I think one can't just state as, oh, this is clearly true.
Okay.
Other questions?
Isn't the proof for that like one or two sentences?
Yes. Yeah.
So effectively
correct. I mean, there is this.
You can write a lot of statements.
There is this story which I've heard being told about multiple famous people, where the professor gives the lecture and says something, and then trivially that holds, and a student asks, "Oh, I don't get this. Why does this hold?" The professor thinks and thinks, that someone says, "No, I can't find this out. Lecture is cancelled. I'll think about it. Come back next time." Comes back next time, starts his lecture. This is all the time, so he just starts, "Gentlemen, I've thought about it. Yes, it is trivial," and he continues. And the weird thing is, of course, the fact that, and that's something they don't tell you initially in the courses, the fact that you're saying something is trivial, this is not a macho gesture as, "I see this immediately, I don't need a justification." Something being trivial, at least the way I interpret it, means it follows immediately from the definition or from the thing we've done before without any further argument. You don't need to start thinking in a complicated way or so. Just use exactly the thing which was there before. And so in some way, with this question, yes, if you put it in the right place, it becomes trivial. But since it's in the homework sheet and not in the right place, I would argue it's just an epsilon more than trivial. But yes, it's not more than 2 sentences. Okay, other questions?
In problem 43, when we want this system of SDRs that can be augmented to look larger, what is the counter example? I couldn't find it.
Oh, basically everyone found
it. Well, it's a subset, right, of the SDRs?
Yeah, what you do is basically you choose your S, for example, the way I would construct it, pick some sets which clearly have an SDR. Okay. And now you add to the sets a few extra points, just very few from a small other set. And you make it so that on this small other set, you can choose SDR there, but that the last set you're adding, somehow that is special, where you actually would need that these first sets exhaust all the points from the smaller set. But the other one is the intersection on the bigger from what you, so what you do is you have your sets here which intersect somehow, and you make it so that they all intersect in some in one small subset, and they still satisfy. Okay, but this intersection isn't yet part of it, and you make that here on this you have the SDRs, and now you pick some other domain and you choose points, you add to every set, you add some points here, and you pick the intersection of all of them, extra is a further set, and you make this intersection here. Well, you could probably, if you construct them right enough, you have you basically want that the only way the condition is fulfilled, that for this you have to choose one of these points. But you have, for the other sets, the way you went through, you chose gratuitously points here, though say they all involve, yeah, so they, let's say your sets would be, if you call this intersection K for kernel, you take K union 1, K union 2, and so forth. So you clearly have representatives out here, but you somehow just didn't choose them, you chose them here. And that's I think, what makes it. Or you could even have the kernel of the empty set. Yeah, you don't even need to have something here. Make the kernel, sorry. Just pick these sets. So what are you doing? Let's do it with two, right? Let's say we choose the set 1, 3, that's one, and I can find a distinct representative. Let's say I choose one here, and now I'm adding the set 1. Can I?
But you can augment this by adding 3. Are you doing this as augmenting it while still keeping?
Yes, while still keeping the existing representatives. Yes.
Okay.
But what it is just to say,
it the other way,
no.
I didn't think it was possible.
No, that is not possible. That's a theorem we've proven. No. This is just to say, if you start naively writing an algorithm for doing it, the naive algorithm, well, any algorithm tries to reduce a problem to a smaller one. So one way of doing it is to say, okay, let's take one set out, let's choose representatives there and choose something else. And that doesn't necessarily work. And that's why you have this augmenting path, this flipping mechanism in the Hungarian method. Okay, sorry.
Oh.
Right, other questions? No? So, what we did last time is we looked at, we've proven the Max Flohm-Minkowski's theorem, and we've shown how to use this to find a maximum flow through a network. And what I mentioned is that the way I described, there is one part in the algorithm where I'm a little bit vague, where I'm saying, oh, now trace through and pick some path from source to target. If you just allow this to be chosen arbitrarily, you can get into a problematic situation in the sense of that your algorithm will not be behaving well. And let me just show you an example of that, how this can happen. So, let's say I have source, I have a vertex A, a vertex B, and I have a target. And let's say I have a lot of capacity here, a lot of capacity here. The 100 is just to be a big number. If you think it's not impressive enough, replace it by 10,000 and it's more impressive.
You can use Avogadro's number.
You can use Avogadro's number if you want to write it there, but why stop there?
You could
take Avogadro's number to the Avogadro's number's power.
Grand CS problem.
Yeah.
That's undergrad where I was doing a graph theory problem and I got to make the wonderful assumption that infinity was 16.
Yeah.
Wait, what?
Yeah, we just, the easiest thing to do is just add factorials.
No. There is a special notation. There is something which is called Graham's number, and there is a special notation which involves up arrows, three up arrows in between, which is exponentiate a number with itself as. That is very. That grows very, very quickly. Or you take the Ackermann function or something like that. That grows also pretty fast. Okay, anyhow. So, and I start with a flow zero, and what I'm going to do is I create my first path. I'm going here, here, here. And because I'm going along this edge one, I can only increase by one. Right? So I now have a flow of one. Now I iterate. And now I'm choosing this path here. So you take a flow one here, reduce that flow back to zero, and take a flow of one here. And I have a flow of two. And now I repeat. Right? So in every step, I'm increasing the flow by one. Even though the obvious flow is 200. And that basically, that shows that if you're not careful with the choice of paths, that can take very, very long, and can iterate very, very long, and is in particular not polynomial time. And there are methods, and what they're basically doing are two things. On the one hand, they are careful in specifying what path to choose. So one strategy is actually to say choose a path which is of shortest length. That would kill, for example, this example, because you can't do that. This would tell you must go this way or this way. And the second part, and that's why we are not doing it here, is then to go through the analysis and actually show that it gives you polynomial time. And that's not horribly hard, but takes some time. So what I want to do instead is to look at something related, which actually, at least it looks as if it comes from this counterexample, and this is something which is called Bress paradox.
I have a question about this.
Yeah?
Just not to go too much into it, but you said choosing this path of shortest length.
Yes.
You could still construct a graph where the maximum flow specifically went through a path with longer length than all the shorter ones.
Yes, but then at some point the shorter one is exhausted, and the shorter one. The problem here is that via this extra way, which doesn't really help you, that limits how big your augmenting path can be. This is assuming the obvious strategy. You put maximum flow through your. You increase the flow along the augmenting path in the maximum possible way. So, yes, it can happen that you have, for example, make it 100 here and 1 here, where the shortest path is not the most capacity. But what will happen in these cases, you once go here, you fill it up. And then you're not going to. Here you're filling it up and you're unfilling it. And therefore, this small capacity path is in the way all the time and limits how you can increase. Here, you go once here by one, and then this is full. And if because you have a shortest path, you can't go back along here. And then you're filling this up and you're done.
Okay.
So that's roughly what is happening.
Okay.
Yeah, so this is Bress paradox, named after the discoverer Dietrich Bress, who is, well, by now he must be retired, professor for numerical analysis. And this is an example which has, well, we are just before an election, so this is obvious, if you want, political or social correspondences. So, let's suppose we have a network of roads, and basically I'm doing something like this network. Just to make it sound a little bit more plausible, I draw it differently. So I have cities A, B, C, and D, and I have a small road from A to B, a small road from C to D. Here in the middle I have a mountain, and then I have two nice big roads. One goes from A to C, and one goes from B to D. Okay, and now what I'm, well, the way I'll argue is with travel times. In some way, this is a bit like reciprocal capacities, but that's just easier to deal with. So, what I will assume now is, well, how long is travel time on these roads? The travel time on this small road is 10x, where x is the number of cars and whatever unit of cars you like, and in total it's in the time units you like. We are mathematicians, not physicists, so we don't need to specify what unit you will be working in at the same time. So if you want, if x is number of thousands of cars, and then this for 1,000 cars it takes 10 minutes, if there are 2,000 cars, which one to go along that road in the time unit, it takes 20 minutes for each car, and so on. Right, the other two roads are bigger, so they have capacity. There the travel time is 50 plus x. They are longer because they go along the curve, but then the effect of having more cars is far less. Okay. And now I want to look at the travel time and the average travel time. Average travel time. Though actually there are a few assumptions. Driver would change roads if they can improve their travel time. So in some way there will be an equilibrium which will develop at some point, and I will describe the equilibrium situation. I'm not going to do all the details about proving that it really is a local minimum. It's not hard to do so, but it's not very, very exciting calculations. So average travel time, and what I assume is that I have six, that x is six. Why six? Because that way I don't get denominators. You can scale it as you like. Well, then basically half the drivers will go that route and half the drivers will go that route. Why that? Because if there were fewer drivers going along one route, clearly the travel time along that route would be shorter and drivers would switch. So by a symmetry argument, half the drivers go the upper route, half the drivers take the lower route. So half take either route. So what's the travel time? The individual travel time is 10 times 3 plus 50 plus 3 is
650. No, because we're splitting.
Oh! Yeah. Is 83 minutes, or whatever you call your time unit. Okay. So that's what the travel time takes. Now, some P people clamor for this to be improved, and so a tunnel is built through this mountain. So we build a new road, and this new road has and that road is, it's shorter than the other ones, but it's also, once you build a tunnel, you build a big tunnel, so travel time along here is 10 plus S. So, what will happen at that time? Someone who drove before that route, right? Or who is already, let's assume they are here at B. If they go along here, with the current traffic, it's 53 minutes. If they go along here, well, we have 30 minutes here, well, one car more, this is 30 minutes and just a little bit, plus 10, plus 1, it's 44 minutes to go from here instead of 53 minutes. That is better, right? So, for someone driving along, it is individually better at this point not to take that route, but to take the new tunnel and go on here. You can do a dual argument for someone who drove that route. For them, it will be momentarily better to go instead like this, instead of going on that route and go here. Right? Because individually, at the moment the tunnel opens, if you're the first one who knows about it, that improves. That is a shortcut for you, and that improves your travel time. You look skeptical?
Mm. What about the first route? Can you go around here?
So, someone who would go that route, they could go either stay on that route, which is 53 minutes till here, well, and then this, that's, but that doesn't really matter at the moment. But that person sees this is open, assuming they have perfect information, they can calculate, instead of going along here, there are currently 3,000, x equals 3 cars here, so if they go, well, x gets a little bit bigger, but if this is in thousands of cars, just one car more doesn't make much of an effect here. So then that is not 30 minutes, let's say it's 31 minutes, let's be generous. And then the new tunnel takes 10 minutes and there is, well, there is just this one car going individually. So far there is nothing, and my new car, as a car I'm going new there, then it's 10 plus 1, so it would be 44. Or if it's a few cars, so far there isn't much, 45 something. It's clearly less than 53. Yes, the 53 becomes a little bit better because that x would become smaller. But so instead of going along here, it is an improvement to go along, to go instead that way. So for either route, taking the new tunnel is an improvement, right? So if you assume rational drivers, well, that's a oxymoron in itself, but rational actors which are doing this, it would, regardless which route you do you did before, individually it would help you with the travel time to go straight through you. Nice. Of course, that increases the traffic along that route. And at some point, because these are small roads, they will clog up. So this will not all traffic will go onto this route. It will stop at some point. And it will stop at the point when an equilibrium has been obtained. The equilibrium is that route takes the same as that route. Okay. And instead of doing the multivariate analysis here, let me just tell you what the equilibrium is. It's not hard to find out
find out where it is, but it's some polynomial calculation, multivariate polynomial calculation. So we have the new equilibrium. Is 2000 or 2 well, x equals 2 along the route a bd. So that's the one, the bottom route with a x equals 2 along a cd, and 2 along a BCD. Okay, and I will show you this, that this is an equilibrium situation. Right. That means together that there is x equals 4 along AB and along CD. Right? Because that is shared by two routes. So, what's the travel time? So, what's the travel time for the route ABD? It is x equals 4, which is 40, plus 50, plus 2. So, it's 92. What is the travel time along this? That is a dual argument. That is also 92. And what's the travel time along here? Well, it is 10 times, it's 40 plus 40 plus 10 is 90 plus 2 is also 92. So we have an equilibrium. And it's not hard to see that at this point, individually, for any driver, it is not worth switching. So if the driver switches, I mean, you just look what would be the new travel time. Basically, the x would slightly increase, so the travel time along that new route would slightly increase. And because it's currently the same, if it increases, there is no gain. So this is an equilibrium. The individual travel time, the average travel time, has increased despite building a new road, which was there to improve the traffic situation. Okay, you might consider this, so here, in some way I'm looking at this in a unidirected situation. The fact that I'm just looking at it this way, and that I'm not looking at potential traffic that way or so, doesn't matter. That's just to make the calculations easier. You could have it in a more symmetric situation and allow traffic here both ways, and the problem is still there. So we have in some way, at least an example of a situation where increasing capacity for increasing road capacity makes the overall situation worse. You might consider this as a theoretical perverse example which is just made by the environmental lobby to condemn the car, but or condemn road building. But it turns out such situations have been observed. In the notes, I have a citation of an article from the New York Times from 1990, I think. Yeah, from 1990, where in Manhattan, 42nd Street, which is a street rather in the middle with a lot of traffic, was blocked. And they had thought this will be a disaster. It was blocked for Earth Day. They had thought this will be a disaster. And it wasn't a disaster. Things worked perfectly fine, actually a little bit better. There is a situation known in Stuttgart in Germany where a road was blocked because of building work.
and the overall traffic situation improved, that actually they decided not to reopen that road again. So, I mean, this is not a typical thing, but that can happen. And if you're cynical or more philosophical, you can say this is the tragedy of the commons. It's the fact that they all can just use this road. This is clearly a very, that's the restricted resource, and now more people are using it, and that's why it makes it worse. But it is clearly a situation where if you just say you let the market resolve itself, it ends up with a situation which is worse than before. And at that point I should stop. I should refrain from commenting more on this.
I love you.
Yeah.
Just this weekend filled out the form to get, we have one of these Volkswagen diesel cars to get the rather money back than return the car.
Okay. Yeah, so and
so in some way what this shows is that even this example here, which you might consider rather abstract or a pathetic case of the bad maximum flow situation, yes, you can translate this to something which has more practical relevance.
There is one last thing I want to do in this chapter, and that is just to mention, to basically close the circle. We started with Dilworth's theorem. We got to max flow min cut. From max flow min cut, we get Dilworth's theorem immediately. Look at the Hasse diagram of the lattice. Make the arrows all go up or all go down, and look at the maximal flow. And then minimum cut is an independent set, and maximal flow, if all the edges have the same capacity, is exactly maximum number of disjoint paths. So you get Dilworth's theorem back from max flow min cut, and indeed there are, in some books it is claimed that all of these theorems which we did in this chapter, well, and Dilworth from the one before, that this is in some way just one theorem. This is the fundamental theorem of discrete optimization or so, and they're just different ways of looking at the same idea, but there is this duality condition which always holds. Right. Okay. Any questions? No? So let me briefly, because I've kept you over time a couple of times already, mention where I now want to go. The next chapter and the notes for this will be on the web for Wednesday, will be about partitions. So we want to partition set of numbers, the numbers 1 to n, into different cells, and we care about, for example, in how many different ways can I do it, but I don't care which numbers are in. So the partition 1, 2 together and 3, 4 together, I would consider the same as 1, 4 together and 2, 3 together. So I want to look at the shapes of the partition. Then I ask, how many are there? And that turns out to be a hard problem. And there are, from that we will get to some other things which are related to partitions, which are, well, at least I find quite interesting as behavior. So these are things where we will be basically using the techniques we have. There isn't that much of new techniques, but these are interesting objects in their own right, and they connect, for example, to permutations and thereby to groups. They correspond to
if you can look at rings of invariant polynomials, which are one of the sources of commutative algebra, and some other things, and yeah, that's so it again will connect to various other areas of mathematics. And that's what the next chapter will do. Yeah, thank you very much, and I'll see you on Wednesday.